Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network, USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flannery. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House, NYU, has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you are enjoying this festive season. We're on our winter break here at NYU and enjoying a lull in proceedings. Actually, our classes don't resume until the very end of January after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. 27th of January, I believe, is when we return to classes. So it's a nice respite to have a little bit of a break and come up for air after all the intensity of the semester. On this week's show, folks, I want to return to our series of podcasts. We are collaborating with our friends in Ireland at thejournal.ie to share with you a series of podcasts that reflect on the 1981 Stardust Fire tragedy. It was an awful tragedy to hit the city of Dublin and indeed the country of Ireland, and the families of the victims have never stopped in their zeal and energy about trying to get some modicum of justice or peace with the events of that sad event in Irish history, particularly poignant because of the age group of the people affected, of course, young people out attending a disco, enjoying themselves with their lives ahead of them. So thejournal.ie have done a very balanced and appropriate approach to reflecting on the events around this tragedy, and I'm privileged and honoured to be able to share this with you here on This Irish American Life. Some of you may or may not be familiar with the tragedy, so it's a good opportunity for listeners here in the United States, in New York in particular, to learn a little bit about this sad history in the event that occurred in 1981. Hard to believe that it is that long ago. I was only young when it happened, so I don't remember the actual event itself as such, but I have to say that the memory of it and the discourse around it and activism around it is something I grew up with in my childhood in Ireland in the 1980s and indeed into the 90s, because it was just such a tragic event and a lack of closure, let me put it that way, in terms of what happened. So I'm too sad about things, but it is a festive season, and it's only this time of year that I can really justify sharing some festive tunes. We're privileged here at Glucksman Ireland House to have Professor Mick Maloney on our faculty. Mick is a world-renowned ethnomusicologist and performer in his own right, and his album, An Irish Christmas, A Musical Solstice Celebration, with Mick Maloney, Athena Turgis, and special guests, is a treat. It was recorded live at the Irish Arts Centre here in New York City. So I'm going to pepper this week's show with some tunes from Mick and Athena's album, each side of our podcast, and to finish us out there, we will be listening to Mick and his guests and getting us into that festive season. I'm playing the Wren song. For any of you familiar with Irish history, the Day of the Wren, St. Stephen's Day, is a tradition that is maintained in some parts of the country still. In the area in West Cork that my father is from, actually, it's still a big tradition, and I always like to remind people of that tradition by sharing Mick's song, The Wren Song, because it reminds us of that wonderful cultural tradition, really what it is, people dressing up, going from house to house, not unlike Halloween trick-or-treating idea, and it's great to see that that tradition continues over generations and time. It's been done, I believe, for hundreds of years, so around St. Stephen's Day, that's December 26th, or Boxing Day as it's called in the United Kingdom, I like to remind people of that cultural tradition in Ireland of the Wrens, or the Ran, as my West Cork cousins pronounce it, and I believe it's strong in Kerry, maybe in other parts of the country as well, I'm not quite sure, but I know in Cork and Kerry it still goes strong. Also, folks, I just want to remind you that we are putting plans in place for our spring series. We have a great lineup of events in store. We are delighted to be welcoming the Vice Chancellor of Oxford, Professor Louise Richardson, by a Waterford woman, is going to come and speak with us in May. We have Professor Margaret Kelleher over from UCD, and she will be doing an event around her most recent book on the Mamtrasna murders. We'll be welcoming Professor Guy Byner, whose recent book has won prestigious awards on remembering and remembrances in the context of rebellion in Northern Ireland. We're expecting to welcome Mairead Ní Maoinigh to deliver the annual Barra O'Donovan lecture. So please tune in to me and you'll hear more, or go to our website if you'd like to find out some more information about what we will have coming up in the spring of 2020. Can you believe we're going into a new decade already? Anyway, to some festive tunes and then to our podcast on Stardust. Enjoy, folks.
My name is Frances Tolliver. I come from Liverpool. 2 years ago, the war was waiting for me after school. To Belgium and to Flanders, to Germany, to here. Fought for king and country I loved here. T'was Christmas in the trenches and the frost so bitter hung. Frozen fields of France were still no Christmas songs were sung. Our families back in England, they were toasting us that day. Their brave and glorious laugh so far away. I was lying with my messmates on the cold and rocky ground, when across the lines of battle came the most peculiar sound. Says I, now listen up, me boy, each soldier strained to hear. There's one young German boy sing out so clear. Singing bloody well, we go, my farmer says to me. Soon one by one each German boy joined in harmony. The cannon rushed its silence and the gas clouds rolled no more. The Christmas brought us rest from the war. Chocolate, cigarettes, and photographs from home. These sons and fathers far away from families of their own. Young Sanders plays the sweet part, and they have the violin. It's curious and unlikely band of men. France was France once more. That farewell speech began to settle back the war. But the question haunted every heart that lived that wondrous night. Whose family have I fixed within my sight? Just Christmas in the trenches and the frost over them all. Frozen fields of France were warm, the sun to feed the sun. That's the wall they kept between us to exact the work of war. Had crumbled and were gone forevermore. In Liverpool I dwell. Each Christmas comes since World War One, I've learned its lessons well. That the ones who call the shots won't be among the dead and lame. And on each end of the rifle, we're the same.
Errol Buckley was 18 years old. He was the youngest brother in a family of 10 children from Donnycarney in North Dublin. Friday the 13th of February was going to be a huge night for him. He'd been working up to it for weeks. There was a disco dancing competition in the Stardust Club that night. Errol had made it to the final.
Well, they started off having competitions up there, up in the Stardust. Every second Friday there'd be different heats, like, you know. We just said I'd come in for the crack, you know what I mean? And I got through to the final then. I think there could have been 20, 25 in the final, like, you know, on that night, on the night of the Stardust, like, you know. All the brothers and sisters, my sister was a go-go dancer. All the brothers looked up, they liked singing and all that, like, the mirrors and all that, you know. But my brother Jimmy, he was a good performer, like, you know. He was able to get up and do a bit, like, on the stage and that, you know. He went in for a lot of competitions. I think there was competitions on down the Donnymead Inn. They used to have nights, like, best dancers and all that down there, and you won a good few of them, like, you know. So you'd be just watching them in the house and all that, moving and that, you know.
The lads took their disco dancing very seriously. Once Errol had got through to the final, his brothers made sure that he'd be ready.
Oh, we were doing all that before we went out. When I got through to the final, all my mates and all that, you know, they were all down up to cheer me on, you know. And you were very nervous, like, you know, because it was the first thing to do this, you know. But the brothers were all, we were all dancing the house before we went out, had a few drinks, you know, and they were telling me each group in the house and they were, you know. But it was a good bit of crack with them, you know. They were egging me on, come on, we have to deal with this, you know. Keep the bumpy tradition going, you know. I was actually doing a bit of practice in the house now, you know. I just have to take this a bit serious. I was looking at the women and all that, and then we get the old meals up, you'd have a few girls, you know. Well, he's good.
Anyone who had been in the Stardust for the past few weeks knew how big a night this was going to be. One of those regulars was Antoinette Keegan, who was heading out with her sisters Mary, Martina and their friends.
There was a big build-up to it for about 2 weeks because we had been there in the Stardust and it was like, you know, the competition was, it was the finals that night, that one girl was going to be picked and one boy was going to be picked. I'd be ringing from my job to my sister Mary and her job, and we'd be ringing other friend Mary Kenny and other friends, right, and saying what you're wearing, and the big build up to the usual. And then, like, other friends would be saying, not let go, not to be told, like, I'm grounded from the last time, right, that I got in late and everything else. But some friends weren't allowed to go, and that particular night it was Friday the 13th, and my father, Lord of Mercy on him, pleaded with us, please don't go, please don't go, it's Friday the 13th. And I just kept saying, Dad, we'll be okay, I'll look after him.
Other parents were superstitious too. Linda Bishop's mother was hesitant to let her teenage daughter go out on the unlucky day.
Yeah, I remember I wasn't in work that day. I was in town and I was on the bus with my mum and my brother. And talking about being Friday the 13th, and I said, hey, Friday the 13th, but I'm still going out tonight, you know what I mean? And then we went inside. It was different when we went in because there was different petitions. Normally the back part was closed off, but because it was going to be such... We always sat in this raised seating on the left-hand side. But when we went in, that was closed off, and the back was open because it was a bigger area. I suppose they were expecting a busier night. It was Valentine's dance competition.
A disco dancing competition pulling in a big crowd might feel a bit odd now, and not anything like the way the younger generation hits the town these days. But there are some common threads between then and now. There's always a place to be. You might have a couple of cans before you head in. People had the same conversations and the same crack. There were a lot fewer places to go out back then, so even if you had no interest in a disco competition, you'd go along anyway. Lorraine McDonald and her sister Teresa both went to the Stardust that night. Teresa wanted to check out the dance, but Lorraine didn't really care. She just wanted to see her friends.
Well, we went to the dancing competition, but I've been there a good few times. She mainly went for the dancing competition. Now, you wouldn't think she was 16 years of age and that, so she'd make herself look older, as most girls do. I fairly regular, so it just happened to be there. It was a regular pit spot I would go to. Or even to the ladder rooms that was in the back. So either it was a fairly regular spot if I wasn't going into town. And that, you'd see people who went to school with it. I mean, you nearly know everybody when you go into it. So it's nearly almost like a community to me because you knew everybody.
Other people ended up in the club that night by chance. Eugene Kelly's brother Robert was 17 and he had a job working on the ships. Robert had been due to sail again for a week at sea the Tuesday before the dance.
Now he used to work from Tuesday to Tuesday, Tuesday on, Tuesday off. And it's strange because of the fact when he went back on the Tuesday, the ship broke down on the Thursday and they were sent off from Rosslare because it was something to do with engine failure. And he ended up the saddest the night after and he was the only one among all his friends. And there must be about 12 of them. He shouldn't have been there.
Selena McDermott was too young to be going to the Stardust, but she can remember three of her older siblings all separately making plans to head to it that night.
It was Willie and George. My mum and dad knew that Willie and George were going to the Stardust, but they didn't know that Marcella was. They had no idea. They thought that Marcella was with a friend and babysitting. Now, Marcella told me that she was going to the Stardust, so I knew she was going. Of course, I wouldn't tell my mum and dad or any of them because I wouldn't rat on her. So she actually had her clothes that she was wearing to the Stardust in a this little black bag that she was sneaking out into the alley. I remember that vividly, very clear. George and Willie were going sort of with their own friends, and I think George was meeting a girl there. I think she was from the country, but she died as well. Then Willie was going with his mates. Yeah, but he didn't know that Marcella was there. She was with Donna Mahon and a few others.
People knew you'd have a good night if you went to the Stardust. It pulled in crowds from all over the city. Maurice Fraser lived a bit of a journey away in Sandymount on Dublin's south side, but he had planned to head across the Liffey to the Stardust that night with his sister Thelma and her boyfriend Michael.
Well, Michael's brother Patrick, Pat, he was dancing in the competition that night. So Thelma and Michael, they were at a function in the pub next door, which is part of the same complex. She was involved in union organising union stuff, and there was a union meeting, gathering like drinks and whatever going on in the next room next door. And then they would go over to the Stardust to watch Patrick perform, you know. Pat was only, I'd say, 16, 17, you know. I initially was supposed to go, but things didn't work out. So, you know, I'm here today to actually tell the story. Maybe I should have been there. You don't know.
Morris had been to the club a few times before, but there was something from a couple of months before the night of the fire that stands out in his memory.
There was a concert on, I can't remember who was playing at that night. The lights went out. Emergency lights flickered for about 10 minutes, going on and off. And the group of singers continued to just with drums and percussion or whatever. But all the staff came out with candles, lighting them there, lighting here. But yeah, that's one thing that I recall.
What Morris saw raises the question of whether there was already something wrong at the Stardust. Safety issues had been repeatedly raised with the owners in the months before the fire. The building itself had been under scrutiny. It wasn't a purpose-built nightclub. Before that, it was a jam factory. It was part of an industrial estate owned by the Butterleys. They were a Dublin family who started off with very little, but became wealthy and successful as they grew their business empire in the 1970s and into the 80s. Patrick Butterley was the head of the family, and the club was run by his son Eamon. The Butterleys really had to fight to open the Stardust in the first place. Starting in 1972, they spent 6 years trying to get planning permission to open venues on the site. Dublin Corporation repeatedly turned them down, but the Butterleys got their wish in March 1978 when they finally opened the complex. There were three venues: the Silver Swan Pub, a function room restaurant called the Lantern Rooms, and the Stardust itself. If you were going to the Stardust on a typical night out, you'd probably pop into the Silver Swan for a drink first. You'd then head over to the Stardust, pay a couple of pounds to the doorman, and head inside. Here's what it'd be like for a regular heading in on a typical night out.
I paid me a few bob to your man at the door in the little booth on your right as you walked in. The fee included a few sausage and chips at the end of the night, but I'd never bother with that. There was a bit of a queue. All the young ones had worn jackets out because it was freezing. I milled behind them as we went from the small corridor of the entrance hall that opened up into the main ballroom. The space was massive, and I had my eye out looking for one of my pals, who I said I'd meet here. They weren't on the rows of chairs in front of you as you walked in. The stage was on your right, facing towards the rest of the ballroom, but your own was on the dance floor yet. The stage was only small, but the space to dance out in front of it was huge. My mate wasn't at the two small bars either side of the stage. I'd normally sit up at the tiered seating on the left, but there was a big curtain separating me from it that night. The other spot was the tiered seating was at the very back, past the dance floor and other seats by the main bar, which was open. As I walked around, I eventually spotted your man, standing at the main bar. Loads of people were already there. I nodded at him to get me a pint as I turned and looked back at the place. Seats in front of me and to the back of me were filling up, and I could see the DJ setting up the decks on stage. I held a couple of seats for my mate as he came down for two drinks, and he ran straight for a piss in the jacks by the side of the stage. It's always easy to find the jacks, even when the dance floor was jammed and the lights were dimmed. I thought to myself, be a good night here.
The movable partition you just heard mentioned was on the left-hand side as you walked in. You'll hear it referred to later as the West Alcove. On the night of the fire, it was closed off, with a long curtain separating the alcove from the main hall. Towards the back, you had more seating in the North Alcove and the bar. There were 6 exits from the Stardust, including 5 fire exits. Whether or not these were locked on the night of the fire would become a crucial part of later investigations. Exit 1 was up some stairs at the very back of the venue. Exit 2 was the main entrance where people came in. Exit 3 was behind the stage next to a set of toilets. Exit 4 was to the right of the stage as it faced out onto the ballroom. Exit 5 was on that same side, slightly further up, as was exit 6. Close to the back wall of the venue. When planning permission was granted, the maximum capacity in the main room of the Stardust was 1,458. It's believed around 840 people were there on the night of the fire. The venue was inspected several times before that night by Martin Donoghue, who worked for what is now called Dublin City Council, but was Dublin Corporation back then. Donoghue was diligent in his work. He wasn't a fire safety officer, because that job didn't exist back then. Instead, he was an inspector of places of public resort, with special responsibility for electrical matters. But, in his visits to the Stardust, Donoghue was on the lookout for anything that could potentially cause safety problems, and he found problems there again and again. He visited the Stardust complex 7 times in just 18 months, between July 1979 to January 1981, and each time he found a problem. A passageway blocked by a large box or loose chairs, an emergency exit with a plastic skip in front of it, an exit door chained and locked. Later investigations would lay out what happened during each of these visits.
On the 4th of July 1979, he found that one leaf of the exit door on the west side of the lantern rooms was not opening fully. He brought this to the attention of Mr. Eamon Butterley on that occasion. He visited the premises again on the 10th of August 1979, and the position had not been rectified. He again drew to the attention of Mr. Butterley. On the occasion of this visit, he also found loose tables obstructing the passageway leading from the main bar to exit 5. He pointed out this condition to Mr. P.J. McGrath.
He paid another visit around a year later.
On the 7th of August 1980, he found that the portable platform close to exit 4 was causing an obstruction, and that there were also a number of loose seats obstructing the passageway on the east side of the building.
The inspector returned again later that month and found a plastic skip full of empty bottles blocking the way out of exit 5.
On the 4th of September 1980, as a result of a complaint from a member of the Gardaí, he inspected the Silver Swan and found an exit door which was chained and locked. He drew this to the attention of Mr. Butterley, who said that he was not aware that the door should be kept open and that he would have it opened immediately.
Butterley, in this case, was somewhat correct. This was not in breach of the relevant bylaws. Donoghue returned later that year and found emergency doors locked. He was unimpressed with the response from staff.
On the 24th of November 1980, he inspected the Stardust again and found that exit 5 was chained and locked, and that the bolt on the panic bar mechanism was broken and the upright piece hanging loose. He brought this to the attention of Mr. Kennan, who explained that the vertical piece had been broken during the evening and that the door was locked and chained for security reasons. He, the witness, insisted on the lock and chain being removed from the door. He said that if Mr. Kennan was worried about security, he should put a man on the door, but the door must be left unlocked. Mr. Kennan then unlocked the door.
On the 15th of January 1981, on a night when there was a big crowd in the Stardust, Donoghue found a passage to one of the exits obstructed by a large box. He told Eamon Butterley and the promoter of the night's event that it had to be removed. Donoghue then found it in between two toilet doors in the main ballroom. The box was eventually taken away. In a letter to Patrick Butterley following this, the planning officer at the corporation noted bylaws which, quote, require that special care be taken to ensure that the means of escape provided for all persons on the premises are at all times maintained unobstructed and immediately available. Eamon Butterley wrote back to say that the exit in question was cleared immediately and that it would not happen again. Quote, I personally take great care to make sure all exits are clear. Again, I assure you that all exits will be kept clear when the public are on the premises. The tribunal would later say that this letter from Butterley was a deliberate attempt to mislead the corporation into thinking that all the exits would be kept in an unlocked and unobstructed condition while the public were on the premises. No one going to the Stardust that night knew any of this. Their biggest problem was finding what to wear and then a way past the bouncers at the front. Susan Darling was heading with her older sister Catherine and their friend Paula O'Brien. It was a fiercely cold night, so as well as looking good, you had to try to stay warm too.
I remember getting ready and my mum's dress. I had my red, I had a red dress on with short sleeves in it. And it was a cold night. I always remember the cold night because I had a big heavy coat as well, big long heavy grey coat. And I remember coming down and saying to me, Ma, freezing out. My mother used to knit Aran cardigans. And she says, you can have a lens and I don't know what happened to her. She says, I'm only at the knitting that. She says, I don't know what happened to her. I said, I won't. So I remember when we got to the Stardust, and sometimes we wouldn't put our stuff in the cloakroom because you had to pay to put it in, I think, didn't you?
Yeah.
We just throw it on the chairs and that. But I said to my friend Karen down, I said, I have to put this cardigan in the cloakroom because if that happens, I may not go home. Because my life won't be worth living.
The Stardust had a late bar, the only one for miles around. You wouldn't have to rush in too early, so you'd often get a drink next door before heading in.
We wouldn't have had a few drinks in the house. We didn't drink as much you know, definitely we wouldn't have been allowed to drink in the house. But now we were just going by a couple of bottles of Carlsberg special brew because I got drunk really quick. But no, we didn't drink. We just all met up at about, I suppose, probably 8 or 9 o'clock in the Silver Swan, which was next door to the Stardust. We'd normally meet in there, and then you go out, because they were quite strict, and if there was a gang of fellas, they wouldn't let them in. So we'd meet different fellas we knew from work, or we knew from the area, and said, will you walk in with me? And, you know, you just walked in with fellas, and that was it. You paid for yourself. It was just only people we knew, do you know what I mean, fellas you knew. And we'd walk in with different fellas just to, like, pretend we were a couple and get in, then go off with their friends, and we'd go off with their friends. But otherwise, lads coming down their own were always refused, you know.
It wasn't only lads on their own. Antoinette Keegan and her two sisters would have their own plan to make sure that they got in.
On the normal nights that going to the start, it's like, if there was a few of us going, we'd have to actually separate ourselves, like, myself and my friend would have to go in, like, and my younger sister, Martina, we'd go in, say, like, a group of three, and then my sister Mary and her friend Mary Kenny, it'd probably be 10 behind us, because if we all go in together, right, they'd be told, no, you can't go in. So that's the way we always had to do. So we'd wait inside, right, make sure that Mary and her friends and the rest of them got in, and if they didn't get in, then we'd leave. But that particular night, we all got in. Now, unaware, like, didn't know that my brother had been refused, because it was only, like, later into the night, then we met a couple of his friends, and they had said that John had been refused, so he wasn't allowed in.
Yeah.
They told him he was too young. Now, he was 17. But they told me he was too young. My younger sister, Martina, she was 16. She had makeup on her, so she got in.
The bouncers knew Errol Buckley was a finalist in the dance competition, so he had no bother getting in with his brothers Albert and Jimmy. They'd been getting him pumped up for the competition all week.
They were magic. They were all into music, and Albert was great in the guitar and all, a great singer. Jimmy, good performer, as I was saying to yourself. Jimmy done a lot of competitions and all that. So we'll put me worried about the devil and all that, you know, man. Just come out and let yourself go and just enjoy it as well, like, you know. It was just Jimmy's daughter's birthday that day, like, you know. Him and his wife come up then, Christine, Jimmy, Albert, all my mates. So it was about 30, 40 was going up just because it was a big night in the Stardust, you know. And getting good backup off them, like, you know. No, as I said to you, we were all in the house and we'd have one or two beers there. And we were all just messing and there were times we wouldn't dance. And then we had to head up because you had to be early, you know, to make sure everyone was there to assign the people in and say, okay, you were allowed a partner, would you? And go in, you were getting in for nothing, like, you know what I mean? And then you could see the crowd gathering then that night, you know, because the disco didn't start till about, it could have been about 12:30 when you got her up and running, like, you know what I mean? We were all out on the floor then, just, they play a load of songs and we were all up giving the lows, like, you know what I mean?
The crowds gathered to watch Errol and the other contenders show off their moves, cheering them on. Some people stood on seats or tables or wherever they could to get a better view. It's already well past 1 a.m. at this stage. Two winners will be chosen, one boy and one girl. Errol pulled out all the stops for Patrick Hernandez's disco hit, Born to be Alive.
Well, what they were doing, they were playing a couple of songs and they were picking out people then, you know, the people that they just, you know, they put aside more or less, and it was going down to say 10 people then, and then they left 10 people go to them, and then there was another girl that won it with me, like, you know. I think there was 3 or 4 judges, so they picked a girl and a guy, like, you know what I mean. So I couldn't believe it, like, you know. We were up on the stage and then we went into the back dressing room with Jimmy and all that, you know, and we all said well done and all that, and we got a few photographs, and he says when we come back out we still have a bit of an encore up on the stage, you know, and we just did all that. So it was great, like, you know. It wasn't even about the prize, just winning the competition, that, you know. We come down off the stage. I come down off the stage. Jimmy was up at the back of the stage and come down after him. We were going back off to the table. I think I had another 0.5 or something. We were back out on the floor. We were all just dancing. And everyone was just scattered, part of the bill, you know, stuff and all that.
It's roughly 1:30 a.m. at this stage. With the competition now over, Errol crowned champion, people took to the dance floor themselves. Others just sat back down to their drinks, or to finish the last of their sausage and chips. These were the first people to realise something was wrong.
Didn't bother dancing, I don't know, for sitting there chatting. I remember sitting, because it was freezing cold, it was a really cold night, and the bouncers passed up and down because of where we were sitting, and we knew the bouncers, you know. And there's a blind chance turn the heating on, this place is freezing. We're sitting there, and then suddenly I got like, do you ever step out of a, if you're out on the street and it's really cold and you step into a shop or something and it's really warm, you get that shudder, your body kind of goes, whoop, sudden change in temperature. And I sat down, I got that shudder, and I said, Jesus, don't tell me they're turning the heating on now. Well, it must be nearly time to go home. And I looked at my watch, and it was 1:33. I was after getting one of these digital watches for my birthday. You know, you pressed, the light came on, it was. So I remember hitting the light and looking and saying, 1:33, now they're turning the heating on. So it turns out, actually, it wasn't the heating, it was the first heat from the fire, I suppose, I felt.
Those who investigated the fire spoke to many people who recalled the moment they realised something was happening. One was Deirdre Brady, who told investigators that she remembered some disturbance around her. She looked through one of the gaps in the blind into the west alcove. This area was empty. She saw what seemed to be a very small fire on the seat in Tier 9 of Row B. The seating in the alcove was tiered, with rows placed above the other. This would have been towards the back of the west alcove. Deirdre thought it could be easily brought under control. Another was Sharon O'Hanlon. Here's what she told the investigators.
Sharon O'Hanlon said that after the disco competition was over, she went back to the table. She remembered Frances Winston asking her whether she could smell burning. She then saw that the blind appeared to be very bright and she looked underneath it. She saw what appeared to her to be the three seats in tiers 7, 8 and 9 of row A on fire, with flames nearly reaching the ceiling. Valerie Walsh also remembered Frances Winston asking her if she smelled smoke or something burning. She said no, and then Sharon O'Hanlon asked her the same question. She then smelt the burning and looked under the blind with the other two girls and saw some seats near the back wall burning.
People closer to the main bar were crouching down and looking under the blind. They could see smoke and a glow behind the blind. This attracted even more people, who were wondering what was going on. Some thought that a fight had kicked off. The music kept playing, and the dance floor was still crowded with people.
The DJ made an announcement right that the winners had been picked, and they got to announce the winner. So then the winners were announced, they went up and got their trophy, and then after that, then everyone was back on the dance floor, and we were back up there dancing away. And literally, I'd say, could have been only minutes. I seen the smoke coming across the ceiling, and I told the DJ that they're letting special effects off. And I said, the DJ that they're letting special effects off. And then my friend said to me, look over there, there's a small fire. Now, when I looked over, it was only a small fire. It was only about 18 inches high.
There was one telephone in the Stardust, just inside the entrance. No one had mobiles back then. Peter O'Toole was using it to ring the guards. His girlfriend Anne Rowe had just had her bag stolen. All 999 calls were automatically recorded and the time logged. Peter called the Gardaí at 1:42 a.m. From the transcript, it's clear that before he can finish the call, the alarm is raised that the Stardust is on fire.
Hello? Yes, hello?
I'm at the Stardust disco, can you hear me?
Yes. Your girlfriend's handbag was robbed.
She's the manager at the shoe shop at the Northside Shopping Centre.
Wait now, would you? Stardust.
Yes, I'm at the Stardust disco. Disco test. My girlfriend's bag went missing. Someone has to take it. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
And where were you? Where were the guards? Where did you meet the guards? What's your name?
Hello?
What is your name? What is your name?
Next time on Stardust.
Yeah, when the call came in, I was on an ambulance. We were told there was a big disco down in Stardust, and there's a lot of calls in from it, that there was a fire in it. We would go down and check it out.
We stood for a minute, I thought, will we win the loo? Will we have a smoke? Will we, you know, while they put this out?
The DJ made another announcement then, for everyone to make their way to the nearest exit, that the fire is out of control.
When I looked down, I could see all the smoke billowing out of the kitchen part, right? And I said, the fucking place is on fire, right? I was expecting the lights to be on, and they weren't. It was pitch dark. I was like, right, how the fuck are we going to get out of here?
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Stardust. In this episode, we talked quite a bit about what it would have been like inside the club. If you go to our Twitter, at StardustPod, we've shared maps and images that can give a clear idea of what it looked like and where the exits were. these details become really important in the investigation into the fire. I'm Sean Murray, and this podcast is produced by Nikki Ryan, with executive producer Christine Bowen. The image in our cover art is by PA Images. Thanks for listening, and please share if you like what you heard, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you to those who have subscribed so far. Episode 3 will be out next Thursday, 24th of October.
the Ran, the king of all birds. Stevens his day was cut the first. Though he was little, his thunder was great. To box me boys and give us a train. When I was born, he killed the doll. I met the Ran upon the wall. Up he walked and knocked him down. A frog in the hickory town. Growling, growling, where's your nest? It's in the bush that I love best. In the tree, the holly tree, where all the boys who follow me. Off at the steps of the town with a pan, give us a penny to bury the ram. The king of all birds, Stephen's day was cut in the forest. Up with the kettle and down with the pan, give us a penny to bury the ram. I follow the ram 3 miles or more, miles or more, miles or more. Follow the ram 3 miles or more, at 6 o'clock in the morning. If there's anyone sick or sore, bring the doctor to the door. Knock at the knocker and ring at the bell, give us a penny for making you well. Me boys and give us the trait. I have a little box under me arm, under me arm, under me arm. I have a little box under me arm. A penny or something to do it no harm. Mrs. Maloney's a very good woman, a very good woman, a very good woman. Mrs. Maloney's a very good woman. She gave us a penny to bury the ram.
We're coming towards the end of the program. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I'd like to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to our website at www.nyuirish.net/radio hour. And I just would like to thank Mick Maloney and Athena Turgis for allowing us to share some tunes from An Irish Christmas, a musical solstice celebration, on this week's program. It's that time of year, folks, where we look back on things and we reflect. I want to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life and for your interest in all that we do here at Luxman Ireland House at New York University and our great friends at irishradio.com, Anya Sheridan, and of course the inimitable Adrian Flanley. Have a happy new year, folks. Enjoy the holiday season, what's left of it, and thanks for tuning in. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.